preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting...
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
To Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action, our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Eco Justice Radio acknowledges that we record the show on the traditional territory of the Tongva and all of their relatives. Welcome, I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, Reclaiming Land, Culture, and Narrative Through Black, Indigenous, and Queer Stewardship, I will be interviewing Layel Camargo, co-founder and co-executive director of Shelterwood Collective. Layel Camargo is a non-binary and trans person who uses they-them pronouns. They are an Indigenous descendant of the Yaqui and Yoemi tribes of Sonoran Desert. They are a co-founder and co-executive director of Shelterwood Collective, a land stewardship project building a retreat center and artist residency. In the last 10 years, they have been a champion of zero waste and veganism, a cultural organizer, and producer for podcasts such as Do We Go Too Far and Climate Woke. In 2020, they were named on the Grist Fixers list of climate activists to follow. Today, we have the honor to explore Shelterwood Collective, a Black, Indigenous, and LGBTQ-led community forest and retreat center that seeks to heal people and ecosystems through active stewardship and community engagement. Recently, they took on the role of stewards for 900 acres of forest in Sonoma County, California, on unceded Kashaya and Southern Pomo territory. Our guest shares what it means and why it is important to heal self and environment through land management, shaping culture change, and narrative shifting, also sought by storytelling. Shelterwood Collective believes that ecosystem health can only be achieved by communities who are in deep relationship with the earth and with one another. The work of Shelterwood Collective extends beyond the forest edge through training and programming focused on anti-racism, decolonizing conservation, inspiring resilient leadership, promoting artistic expression, and community health. Thank you for tuning into Eco Justice Radio and our show, Reclaiming Land, Culture, and Narrative through Black, Indigenous, and Queer Stewardship. I am your host, Jessica Aldridge, and it is my honor to welcome our guest, Layel Camargo, co-founder and co-executive director at Shelterwood Collective. Welcome to Eco Justice Radio.
Hey, so nice to be here.
Great to have you. I'm excited for today's show. Well, let's jump right in and have you explain what is Shelterwood Collective?
Yes. Shelterwood Collective is a Black and Indigenous LGBTQ-led community forest and retreat center, healing people and ecosystems through active stewardship and community engagement. A lot of the work that we do really centers on creating a space that folks feel empowered to take care of a forest, as well as telling the story of those particular groups that don't necessarily get seen, and bring in artists into the space to help activate them, as well as allowing our movement groups to just come in R&R, just retreat and rest.
And how did it start? How did Shelterwood Collective come about? When did this idea come?
I will say that it is a very fun story, because it came out of a hot tub, really. So my co-founder, Nico Alexander, and myself, we had just wrapped up a farmer's immersion program at Soulfire Farm in upstate New York and near Albany. And the last day, we were invited to attend a local Buddhist temple that had a homemade hot tub. And so we just spent a week with a bunch of Black and brown dope people hearing about food sovereignty, which is basically the right for us to take back our food production, and how food is made and access to organic and local foods. And so we just learned about food sovereignty. We're on this 80-acre farm that's ran by two Black women, and we were feeling so inspired. My co-founder is a queer Black man. I am Indigenous descent. I'm Yaqui and Mayo and Latinx, and I'm queer and transgender. And as soon as we saw this hot tub, we're basically undressing before they invited us. And so we get into this homemade hot tub that had to get heated up by wood burning underneath it. Very dangerous. We clearly did not care. And we're sitting there as other people are like, wait, they're debating whether they should get in. We're already enjoying this. And so the like-minded souls, we were debriefing what this experience was. There's a lot of pain and suffering in realizing that our folks have been taken away from our lands, forcibly removed, either through the history of slavery in this country or through putting folks in reservations or forced migration. And I was like, I think we need a land project. I think if we could get 1 to 2 acres, we could do food production. We could do the healing that is needed for our folks to be able to return to land stewardship. At the time, I was a climate justice activist focusing on cultural organizing, arts, and culture through storytelling. And I was feeling really activated at the time about just realizing that no matter what I did, the return to land stewardship was the holistic way to resolve this crisis. He was in forestry school learning about Western and European influenced forest management practice that did not center Indigenous communities nor traditional ways of stewarding. And so when I said 1 to 2 acres, he looks at me and he goes, how about 10,000? And at the time, it was very out of context. I did not know this guy was literally taking care of forests in the East Coast. But my initial thought was, why haven't I dreamt big enough for my people? My ancestors were nomadic to the Sonoran Desert. You can find winter sheds for them in Southern California. There are trails that are named for them in parts of Southern California, as well as in Southern Arizona and in Northern Mexico. We have a river, which is our watershed, a traditional watershed. And we were used to taking care of thousands and thousands of acreage. That's why we moved around during the seasons. That's why we chose to be in a nomadic community. And for me, that really opened up the opportunity of thinking through, if I want to survive this crisis, I need to return to my ancestral ways, which that looks like tending to land. And for him, it was, as a Black queer man, how do we return to stewardship in a community way? And so our visions came together. And so we started to incubate it at the end of 2019 when the shutdown happened. It just expedited the need, specifically around the murder of George Floyd, just realizing how vulnerable our communities continue to be. So looking at that with the shutdown, the lack of accessible health, and then the delay in vaccinations in our communities just really helped us feel the fire for this. And so when we had the opportunity to pitch to a funder, we asked for multi-year commitment so that we could leave our full-time jobs and be able to dedicate our energy towards this. And in July 11th of 2021, we closed on a 900-acre forest in Northern California, which is unheard of to have that large scale of space. So it's been a journey of love, and it all started with hot boiling water, which ironically our logo is water drop and a fire symbol, because to be in right relationships in this ecosystem, we need to be in good relationship with water and fire.
And why is Shelterwood Collective LGBTQ focused, and why is queer stewardship so important?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you ask that to any of our collective members, they might have a different answer, they might not. But for me, I'll start with what I think, and then what we have decided it to mean for our organization, which is, as an Indigenous person, when you look at the circle and the fabric of our village, everybody has a role. The women have a role, the men have a role, the children have a role, our ancestors, our elders have a role. Queer people have been specifically targeted and removed from our roles. And that's because our tribes were trying to survive when they were getting colonized. For me, as a two-spirit, transgender, non-binary human, me returning to land stewardship is returning back to the circle of our existence, that I have a role in taking care of this earth. I have a role in taking care of my family. I have a role in taking care of my community. And that's not written in any history textbook. It's not something that I can Google. A lot of our history of us even existing has been eradicated and hasn't really been available until the last 20, 30 years. So it's important because queer people are disenfranchised in our society, and they get kicked out of homes, they get kicked out of communities, they get ostracized in education and in workspaces. And although things are changing, we still have a lot of healing in regards to what is our place as we're moving towards a climate crisis. What is our place when we are so attached to urban communities because that's been necessary for our survival? And what we want to do is create a stewardship project that isn't traditional. Most stewardship projects, you have a mom, you have a dad, you have kind of this heteronormative function of how the land is taken care of. And what we're saying is, this is going to be a refugee space for queer folks so that they can learn how to tend to large scale land and also be resilient in ways that are centered around water conservation, centered around working with good fire, because I want us to have a fair shot at survival.
People may have heard the phrase returning to the land, but what does that really mean? Are we giving up our creature comforts and disrupting our way of living, or is it that drastic?
Oh my God, in no way, shape, or form are we giving up our comforts in regards to the things that we like. I think we're just shifting how we engage with our resources. There's an amazing organization that I've been fortunate enough to support, which is called Movement Generation. They're an ecological justice organization. And they taught me this really amazing line, which is, we have to remember our way forward. And there's contrary statements there. It's like remembering, but also moving forward. And so, but the idea behind that is that there is a lot that the last 300 years, the colonial system, the education system, Western dominance has pushed on us to be dependent on our current capitalistic system, how we bank, how we survive. And that the reality is that there's eons, thousands and thousands of years prior to that of survival that has actually been in regenerative relationship with the earth. So what we want to help create is a world where we can transition from the quote unquote toxic behaviors and be in better relationship with the earth like our ancestors have for many, many years. And that doesn't mean having to give up. When you say creature comforts, I also kind of want to break that down a bit. But what my assumption is the ways that we live now, which is like takeout. Takeout has been a really hard thing for me, but takeout, you know, all these things that create disposables. When we start to change the culture to be in rightful relationship with the land, whatever that looks like around you, the political and economic systems have to follow. We saw this through the single plastics campaign. We saw this through folks starting to invest more in renewables. We don't need to move too far away from what makes us happy, but there are these subtle things that we will have to exchange in order for us to be in right relationship, to limit pollution, to limit the toxins in the air, toxins in the water, but that we can still live comfortably. And urban communities, metropolitan areas, are the most harmful to the environment at a scale of pollution and carbon emissions, but that there is a way to transform them in a way that is going to be regenerative. So I'm not going to go down too much of that dark hole. And I know you guys are in Los Angeles, so you probably think about this a lot. But what we're really asking is for people to just shift the culture around our investment and connecting with your ecosystem. What's the tree look like in front of your house? Are you growing food at a community garden? Are you buying locally? Do you know where your watershed comes from? Do you know that? And that is a return to land.
I throw composting in there and how we're managing our waste.
Yes, waste. Yes.
Waste. How does, I know you spoke to this a little bit, I wanted to talk a little further. How does land stewardship push what is possible for Indigenous, Black, and queer communities?
I feel like when our folks got forcibly removed from their lands, either through slavery or just the colonial project that was, and that still is the 500 years in our country, people were strategically removed from having a relationship to the land, because having a relationship to the land makes you sustainable. If you can test the health of your soil, if you know the quality of the air, the quality of the water, you're resilient. There's literally nothing better than those three things for your survival. And what we've seen across the few generations from that forcible removal is that folks have become traumatized from that. So for us to return to land stewardship means that we can coexist together, and that we're working on creating a new world that helps us heal, but also dream of what's possible now that we understand the soil quality around our homes. We understand what wildfire resiliency could look like in a forest or in a city that's near where the fires roll down the hills. And so for us as Indigenous and Black and queer community, that really means feeling empowered and audacious to not only feel hopeful for the future, which has felt difficult for us for generations, but to also be leaders and innovators of what's possible now, because we have a particular lens of what the removal has impacted our ability to exist and thrive. So it's I'm telling you, it's the dream. If you understand what the soil quality, the water quality is for where you live, it doesn't matter where you are, your ability to feel empowered and resilient is going to drastically change. And I think that's something that for me and Nico really drove us to creating this organization. We wanted to not only know these things, we wanted to have more control over it, because we were tired of greedy people making those decisions for us.
I have one more question for you before we go to the break. tell us about the prediction that the majority of land currently used for domestication will be on the market in the upcoming years due to our, you know, our economy, food production, climate issues. And why is this prediction important to the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so one of the big areas of work for us is to touch, move, and inspire people to create their own land projects. Given that most of the land that's used for agricultural use or homesteading is owned by white wealthy folks who run corporations, given that climate change is pushing at what's possible in regards to profit markets at this particular sector, that as things begin to shift in regards to climate change is making it harder to grow food, people are becoming more aware of their consumption patterns. So the profit margins are dropping for these corporations that have thousands of acres where they're completely extracting. That means that these lands are going to be overturned and put on the market. What's happening is that collectives like ours are committed to organizing and creating a new narrative so that when these lands get put up for sale, the person who is selling them, the corporation who's considering selling them, will have kind of a pushback, everything from narrative to cultural norms around that those lands need to get returned to Indigenous people, or that those lands need to get prioritized to given to Black, Indigenous, and people of color collectives. And a lot of that is because we genuinely believe that if lands are returned to our people, it's through our cultural practices, it's through our ability to heal with the land that will make this land more resilient. And so we are organizing not only through doing narrative change so that people see that land back, returning the land to Black, Indigenous, and people of color hands is part of our climate resiliency, but also we are committed to helping collectives grow exponentially as this 95% of land gets returned. And additionally to that, we're looking at ways in which we also become kind of a vehicle to help those land transitions be prioritized for our communities, for Black, Brown, Indigenous, queer communities.
Thank you. We're going to take a break real quick and be back to continue the conversation in regards to Shelterwood Collective, how people can get involved as well, and the types of trainings and trauma work and the things that you're doing. So everyone stay tuned and we'll be right back.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected with us by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, Eco Justice Radio. You can check out previous shows and guests, and, well, you can get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Reclaiming Land, Culture, and Narrative through Black, Indigenous, and Queer Stewardship with host Jessica Aldridge and guest Layel Camargo, co-founder and co-executive director at Shelterwood Collective.
Layel, what does getting involved look like for someone that wants to visit or learn from the Shelterwood Collective?
Yeah, so I think on the front end is I just want to be honest, we closed on the land, which we like to say that we pay ransom on it, in July 11th, 2021. So we've only been holding title, for lack of better words, since, you know, a little over a year. We all moved here. So our three full-time staff, our resident anthropologist, and our resident farmer started to move here December 27, 2021. So I will be honest that we are very new to the game. But right now, what it looks like to get involved is to, first off, follow us on Instagram. And if you can, sign up for our listserv online. And through that, we have a volunteer sign-up form that we encourage folks to fill out to kind of list out what kind of skills they have, how much time they would have to offer. And we recently wrapped up, so that's one way, is we have ongoing volunteers. So you can either get reached out individually because of what you fill out, or you'll get emailed on a group whenever we're doing a burn, or if we're doing setting up defensible space on staff housing, or we have a volunteer opportunity coming up the first or second week of October. So if you're listening and you're excited, go check out our website, get on that list, and you'll get the email coming up. We recently wrapped up 10-week fellowship with Brown University, where we had five fellows living on the land. They were focusing on documenting rightful relations, building a community strategy for engagement, two foresters, and then communications fellow that helped us really share what we're working on. And so we'll be looking at potentially doing these every so often. We're hoping for once a year. But when you're here, you're all hands-on. So we jump in where it's needed. Sometimes it's moving wood to a different location. Sometimes it's building bat houses because we just move them from the roof of a building. Sometimes it's painting or spackling walls because we really want to get folks moved in. And then the rare occasion is you might learn how to use a chainsaw, and you might actually go out and do that or do gully filling as we prep for the heavy rains. So it's very seasonal. It's very much by demand. And when you're here, because we're such a startup, you get to try out a lot of different things. So everything from infrastructure and building to actually land tending, which could be fire, chainsawing, gully filling, et cetera.
There's a lot of technical skills that people can learn. Especially the chainsaw. I'm down. but there's a lot of healing, yes, and trauma work that happens, that's taking place. How does trauma work play out in the work that's happening at Shelterwood Collective?
Oh, I love this question. It comes to me at a beautiful time. We have a wellness track for our staff. And so we just had a 2-hour meeting with our wellness facilitator today where we learned about how the body responds to trauma and stress. And so I'll start with our staff, which is that living on a land full time when you're at threat of wildfire coming by, as well as the constant threat of drought, which is happening in the state of California and on the west coast of the US, there's a lot that gets activated. There's this running joke that we have, which is when folks come up the first day, you feed them a lot of food, because there's something about us being in nature that when that first night, all we want to do is eat. And I think it's our natural instincts kicking in that, like, oh, is food scarce? Do we need to, like, you know, store up for the winter? And there's something so beautiful that we have gotten to witness with each other, which is when you're out here, we're collecting our own water, we collect our own septic. We're really trying to live as connected and regenerative with the land, which means not dependent on municipalities. A lot of things could go wrong. A pipe burst could mean you don't shower today. And that's how we were living. So there's a lot of opportunities here for your traumas to get triggered. But with that, and I think this is one of the big catalysts why Nico and I wanted to start a land project. When we were at Soulfire Farm, I witnessed women through harvesting crops, through planting seedlings, through working in the greenhouse, feeding chickens, transitioning chickens. I got to witness women processing sexual trauma. And one of the things that my mentor, Gopal Dayaneni, taught me is if you're ever feeling stressed out, just go outside, get a good piece of soil, put it up against your face and just smell it. And there's something that happens to your body when you smell healthy soil, which is you start to release some of those happy hormones. And there is a way in which being in relationship with the land is healing. You feel so much more connected to your ancestral ways. You feel much more connected to your existence as a human. You feel connected to something where our current world makes it really difficult to feel connected to anything. And so many people who are privileged enough can seek out the outdoors recreationally. And for our people, they're out here with us. So if you're volunteering, you will have days where we'll kind of just say, like, why don't you just go enjoy the forest? Go for a walk, go for a hike. Because we understand that the connection with land is labor itself, and that there's a lot of processing and releasing that happens when you're out in the outdoors. Our communication fellows this year is studying the connection between the outdoors and how the Western system diagnoses and helps heal with certain trauma or illnesses. And it was so beautiful to have her here because she was constantly encouraging us to remember that healing actually happens when you're just in connection with the land. There isn't much science behind it, but I will tell you the way my body feels after I hug a tree just feels amazing. And that's something that my aunt taught me, who's grew up in a really cement city in Mexico. So yeah, I hope I answered that well.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Reminds me of, I have a friend of mine. He's like, I said, I stop and smell the flowers. He's like, you literally stop and smell the flowers. He's like, that's a saying. And I was like, well, someone said it because it's right. Like, there's a reason why it exists.
No, that's so true. During the shutdown, the highlight of my day was walking around my block and stopping and smelling the flowers. I did get really bold and I started petting the bees. I would ask them, can I pet you? And then they'd give me their little booties, and I would take that as a form of consent. And then that was the highlight. Like, I would walk my dog around the block and I'd see how many bees will let me pet them today. And it was so healing. It got me through the shutdown.
I hear that. Let's break down the focus areas of Shelterwood Collective. Those being, one, large-scale land management, two, shaping culture change, and then three, narrative shifting. And I know we've touched on all of these within our conversation, but I want to dive into each one of these a little bit. So the first one, define what you mean by restoration of the land as it applies to large-scale land management.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. We did touch a little bit on this. Is the reality is that for a lot of us, our ancestors, they managed, I'm using a very colonial term, but they managed a lot of land. There were thousands of acres, depending on where you come from, just by the realities of either needing to move seasonally because of the weather, or that's how they had built their food sheds. And when we think about a restoration project, is what our people think of what's possible is usually attached to food sovereignty, so the ability to grow your own food. And for us, what was a big turning point, as I mentioned, was the ability to dream of stewarding at the larger scale, not just 3 acres or 80 acres or 100 acres, but we were really dreaming for 10,000. So we like to say that 900 was the compromise. And the reality why that is for us is climate change is happening right now. We're witnessing how bad it can get. And given the measurements of tipping points, as well as what we've learned from science data with the lag effect, we are in it for another 50 years. If we stop now, if we stop pollution, carbon production, and we can really get ahead of it. So for us, how do we make ourselves more resilient is actually scale the impact of our values. And you can only have the scale of that impact of your values, which is centering Indigenous leadership, centering Black folks' knowledge, learning of the traditional ways, because that's what's ecologically aligned. I can have impact on 2 acres, or I can have impact on 10,000 acres. And what we want is for our people to see the value in them having access to large scale, and that restoring that land is not only their duty, but it's their birthright. That's what's been removed.
What type of traditional Indigenous Black land stewardship practices are you employing?
Mm-hmm. So here, because we're in Northern California, we are hit with wildfires as well as drought. So our soil is completely depleted, which makes it harder for water retention to be absorbed, and it's depleted because of the drought. So when a wildfire comes in, it's way more dangerous because of the years of fuel that has been stacked up, because traditional Western forest practices say that humans are bad, only certain skilled people are allowed to steward the forest. And so you have this cultural belief that if you keep humans away from a natural ecosystem, the natural ecosystem will be fine. What we're saying is, for thousands of years, that was inaccurate for our people. We believe that we had to take care of the lands. We had to go in and say, we want more redwood, so let's actually scale back on the Doug fir. Let's see how we can preserve and or help water flow in a way that will help the redwood grow. Oh, there's these bushes that are helping mitigate bacteria. Let's put them in an area where there's a lot of fungi growth that's actually depleting a particular tree. Our ancestors actually created the forests that we live in. And Western ideology has eradicated the ability for us to do that. So in returning that belief, what we are practicing is good fire. Wildfires are horrible and they cause a lot of damage. the reason why they're so bad is because the forests have not been tended to. There's way too much fuel on the ground. There's way too many trees that have not been cut. And then you have keystone species like the black bear who would be helping with that, like the coho salmon who would be helping with that, just becoming eradicated because they're being impacted by the same systems we're being impacted by. So we're working with our endangered species and we're basically becoming them. What they did to help the ecosystem, we're mimicking them. So and so we're coupling that with the traditional ways of the Kashaya, which is returning good fire, and also we are mimicking the endangered species that would have abundantly been here, like the black bear, like the coho salmon, and what they were giving to the natural environment so that it can stay resilient when wildfire comes through here, because it will at some point, and we will instigate it because we want fire here. It helps the oak germinate. It helps sprout more resilient trees. So those are some of the technical things that are happening here in Sonoma County in our particular land, and that's across the board, but a lot of folks nearby are also learning to practice.
Thank you. Do you have a formal relationship with the local indigenous groups?
Yeah. So we recently had some folks come out from the Kashaya Reservation, and it was so beautiful to have them walk the lands. We were doing like an archaeological survey is what we would call it, but really we were just like walking with them and letting them just show us how they would want us to engage with the land. So we found some really awesome archaeological facts of just like a pestle and mortar near an oak tree and just how folks would just set them up everywhere. So it's been beautiful to start to build those relationships. And I'm moving towards building a cultural easement. So traditionally in a lot of places, you would have a conservation easement, which will protect like the northern spotted owl or will protect the redwood, meaning it allows a lot of speed bumps before you can hurt their ecosystem or before you can cut a tree down, which helps preserve them. A cultural easement, something fairly new, which we add the cultural component. So it will create a legal binding document that says that the Kashaya have access to their lands based off of this particular title in perpetuity. And so what I'm looking to create with the local tribes is what are some cultural practices that we can make legally binding. So one of them is when you find an artifact, the Kashaya actually prefer that the artifacts stay in the ground. So we can take a photo of it, we can document where it is, but we have to bury it again. Another is that men are not allowed to touch artifacts that are found on the land that women have used.
Going back to the three areas of focus for Shelterwood Collective, the next being shaping culture change. What is meant by shaping culture change and how does that play out?
Yeah, I mean, I spent the last 10 years of my life trying to shift the conversation away from polar bears and melting ice caps to the impacts that are happening on Black and Brown communities. And when I went to Cancer Alley in Louisiana, I had this moment of realizing how racism coupled with the greed of oil production was literally causing the generational death of certain Black families that were descendants of formerly enslaved people. So this to me really seeded the fact that there is a larger cultural movement that needs to happen before we can be in right relationship with the planet, and that starts with our people. So what we're looking at Shelterwood Collective is actually touch, move, and inspire Black and Brown folks and Indigenous folks to be in connection with the land is the minimum that we are asking. And at the larger scale is asking folks to be audaciously enough to manage land, something that is very difficult. So our hope is that we will create a cultural movement of people feeling invested in taking care of land and being a solution towards climate change versus waiting for politicians and folks in economic power to make those decisions for us. So we are shaping a new narrative, which is that Black, Indigenous, and people of color can actually change the planet. We can change what is possible for us. Retreat space is very central to this work. Being able to host people overnight will allow them to be connected to the space. And it's that connection to our ecology that we want folks to deploy their power and what their purpose is on the day-to-day.
Thank you, Lael. We're going to take a quick break. So our listeners, stay with us. We're going to come back, talk about what is meant by narrative shifting, what they're doing on the land for green building and landscaping techniques, and much more. So stay tuned and we'll be right back.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected with us by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, Eco Justice Radio. You can check out previous shows and guests, and, well, you can get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Reclaiming Land, Culture, and Narrative Through Black, Indigenous, and Queer Stewardship with host Jessica Aldridge and guest Lael Camargo, co-founder and co-executive director at Shelterwood Collective.
Welcome back, everyone. Next question for you, Lael. The third area of focus for Shelterwood Collective is narrative shifting. How is this achieved through storytelling, and what other ways do you manifest narrative shifting?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it right now is we're looking at how do we create content to show what we're doing. So we try to really think of our work as it's also a storytelling project. Who is at the leadership of the decisions that we are choosing to make in regards to the stewardship practices? And how do we inspire people to be able to dream beyond what's possible for them right now? We are so fortunate enough that we have a resident anthropologist who's been following us for about 10 months, and he is documenting these initial stages for us. They are not easy. They have been difficult, and they've come with barriers, everything from who do we partner with to how do we keep the lights on to how do we fundraise in a way that's holistic and sustainable for us. And I feel like we make mistakes, but we're also doing a lot of really great things. One of the things with this narrative shifting work has also been hearing how other land projects succeed and how they have failed. So what we're hoping is to launch, continue sharing our stories through social media, but the goal is for us to launch some more intentional packaging of our lessons learned to also allow our staff to be able to share from their perspective what is changing for them. And the goal is to change people's perception, how to be in a relationship with endangered species. How do you decide when you thin or when you fell a particular tree? What is the difference between good fire versus bad fire? How are humans actually good for an ecosystem, not bad? What does managing a forest in the age of climate change look like? And we're really hoping that we can inspire also politicians and folks who are in economic positions of power to expedite, you know, what they're doing and for it to be holistic. So I feel like we have our hands full in regards to what we're trying to change about the story and how we tell it. And we want everybody to feel connected with us in some way, shape, or form.
So through this conversation, you've mentioned various roles, various skills that people bring to the land, to Shelterwood Collective. Not everyone on the land is a permaculturist or a forester by trade. I've written down wellness facilitator, farmer, anthropologist, cultural organizer like yourself, communication fellow. There's so many. Share with us, you know, this diverse talents that the people possess who are stewarding the land, why this is important, and how this is analogous to the importance of biodiversity in an ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, so I feel like traditionally you think of a land project, and this happened at the early stages before folks really understood our vision, was like, oh, you're going to have a farm. So who's your farmer? And are you going to grow food? And I feel like that's the initial question. The reality is we are, because our work is about changing the culture, we need everybody to be invested in the stewardship of land. And in order for that to happen, we need to help empower people that irregardless of your role, irregardless of your job, you have actually a skill to offer stewardship. So the reality is we do have a lot of different folks. My partner who lives here, who's helping with our retreat director, she comes from the museum world. She opened up the Museum of Motion Pictures, the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures, and then came here. And so now she's helping us build our retreat space. Why is she essential to this? She needs to be connected to land because we're human. We belong to the land. What are her skills? Building large institution from the ground up. And that she has been critical in helping us think through accessibility, think through youth incorporation, think through all these things that just make, is gonna make our retreat center that much more accessible. And so we also have a disability justice activist that is helping us create the culture of how to be inclusive, to think beyond ADA compliance, to think about how are we slowing down when somebody is here with a mobility issue. How do we help create a space where folks who depend on defibrillators or machines full-time can exist here? So what the reason why we lean into this is because beyond the reason why we lean into this is because when we look at our ecosystem, the biodiversity that is instigating the thriving aspect of a particular ecosystem requires the worms, the ants, the beetles, the trees, the fungi, the birds, four-legged, to be in harmony with each other. One of them can't dominate the other, but they all have a particular role. Our communications people are telling the story to touch, move, and inspire not only our communities, but funders to keep supporting us. Our community strategist is thinking through when we decide we are going to start hosting large groups of communities, folks that come with their own sets of traumas and goals, how can we hold them in the best way that supports? When I come in to help with a building infrastructure, I'm thinking through, are we gonna spend a little bit more and buy some wool material for insulation? Or are we gonna go with the cheap stuff because we have to cut to buy the bamboo floor that is more sustainable? And so we all come in with our sets of expertise. And at the end of the day, we want a biocultural diversity that is inclusive of the human experience, the human skills that are here on the land, because we are not separate from our ecosystem. So in this scenario of the worms and the beetles and the birds and the trees and how they all are in balance, we are also a part of that. So we're learning how we are a part of that.
I want to touch upon how you're incorporating disability and access compliance and narrative into your work and the physical space of Shelterwood Collective. Can you expand upon that? I know you just mentioned it, but you're doing some really out of the box thinking, but it is when mm-hmm. you go into spaces and so many, the majority, don't think in this manner or take things into consideration.
Yeah, thanks for asking that question, because I think this is an area of our work that we want to make sure gets a lot of attention. And as you can hear, we're already being so ambitious. So there's only so much we can talk about. So when we started this project, before we even landed on a land project, we knew we wanted to be accessible. And so accessibility, when you think about it, is how close are we to a city that has the highest concentration of LGBTQ community? We are 2 hours from San Francisco. We are 30 minutes away from the gayest rural town in the whole country, which is called Guerneville. So we are accessible to queer community. How are we accessible to BIPOC communities that might not have a connection to the outdoors? We are off a main road, but we are still not accessible in regards to driving. Folks see a lot of Trump flags. Folks are driving on dirt roads. So at the moment, we are thinking through the curation of that 3-mile stretch to give folks comfort that they're headed to a safe space, which is hard for our folks. And then we had to tackle and think through, how are we accessible to folks with disabilities? That was a hard one. So we decided we wouldn't do it by ourselves. So we brought in a disability justice activist who's also an amazing writer and has been working with Sutter Health to help them stay in compliance with their ADA accessibility. Her name is Yomi Rong. She's an amazing Black elder. And so she's come up to the land a few times, and she's starting to hold space for us to think beyond ADA accessibility while also working with our general contractor to make sure that they are meeting the actual compliances that are needed for that. Moving forward, we are looking at creating a 2-story, 17 or 18 bedroom facility that will be universally designed. We learned about universal design through Yomi, which means that we're going to be looking at everything from how bright lights are to what visual cues we give in case of an emergency for folks who can't see. And so we're trying to hit everything from accessibility and mobility, sight, hearing, and anything else that we can think of, and thinking about backup generators so that if somebody does depend on power for their livelihood, they can still have access to that in short or long term when there are power outages. So it's going to be a big feat. And so what we're hoping through this accomplishment is that we really push what retreat centers are making possible for folks with disabilities, because often we've heard too many narratives of people spending thousands of dollars to go to a retreat, being assured that they could use the bathrooms, and then spending 3 to 5 days not being able to shower. We've heard this from several folks in the disability community. The outdoors is so healing. I'm sure most of your listeners can agree that when they go on a hike, when they hug a tree, when they smell breath, you know, some fresh air, just how great it feels. Can you imagine being physically unable to access that? And we're not talking about just class. We're talking about I cannot leave my home because I'm in a wheelchair or I'm bedbound. So we're really thinking of how do we do that. And so most recently, we've started to think about electric vehicles that can help take folks around the land so they can experience the most of the 900 acres.
So in building these spaces, making sure that they are accessible across the board, you're also incorporating and ensuring green building and landscaping techniques into renovations, into new constructions of the facilities on the land. Can you speak more to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always been our goal to be, as we say, in a rightful relationship to land, and that looks like minimizing our waste and the impact that we have here, knowing that we will have impact. And so we held a 4 to 5 day visioning session in December of last year, in which we had about 150 folks show up, and they were in the category of local community, Black, Indigenous, and POC communities, organizations and partners, and artists and artist organizations. And then we had a miscellaneous that was a virtual for folks who just in general couldn't attend. And so we heard from them what they wanted to see in the space. They were presented with mood boards, they were presented with tours, they got to see some of the facilities. And across the board, we knew that folks were really looking for a place that was more regenerative with the land and a place that was restful, but also where they could learn. And so we're really using that as a pillar. And so we worked with an architecture firm during this time, which is called Methune. And they also presented a set of alternatives to gray water catchment system or particular ponds that were specifically located on the land so that folks can kind of throw in some ideas in there. And now that they've handed these blueprints of kind of what it's going to look like per se, they're more like mood boards than blueprints. They really drew the outside of the space and what it would look like finalized. The blueprints are necessarily completed, but
what are you doing? We talked about threat of fire, and we talked about Indigenous practices, and what are y'all doing to protect your buildings from the threat of fire?
Yeah, I mean, we're in Sonoma County. This county has seen some of the largest fires in the state of California in the last 5 years. So when we decided to move here, we had a mapologist and a few folks kind of help us think through what was the rainfall looking like, how close fire has gotten to the property in the last 10 to 30 years, and then a few other things in regards to topography, the ecosystem, and what trees were thriving in this area. So we came in really knowing what we were facing. Fire has gotten really close to the 900 acres. And so as soon as we got here, first of all, we had to do a lot of like nervous system regulation because that was a bit scary to start to think of. But then once we settled, then we realized how much water there is and how resilient this place has been, even though it's come close to fire. A lot of what we're doing is removing the fuel from the bottom part of the tree. So that's the stack, the years and years of stack of pine needles or leaves and debris that just gets stacked on that when a fire comes through, we'll burn all of that up. In traditional practices, that would have gone taken care of yearly or every other year. And it would also help germinate particular seeds that we would want those trees to grow. What we're also doing is doing some thinnings. So we're looking at trees and really cutting from the bottom up. This is the part where I was mentioning the black bear, if it was here, it would help us. They would scratch their back on the trees and bring down some branches at the height that we need them to, so the fire doesn't climb. And then we're also looking at encouraging trees that are more fire resilient to thrive. So that looks like coming in and cutting some of the more flammable trees that are just coming up, that are increasing the density of the forest. Hundreds and hundreds of years ago, if you would have looked at this forest, it would have actually been thinner. It wouldn't have been as dense. The density in a forest means that the humans aren't managing it well. And that means that it becomes a little bit more of a fire hazard. And with that comes us changing our mind frame of how we think about fire. It's not something that we should be scared of. It's a tool that we are using. And so we're learning that good fire is the best fire. You put it somewhere, you contain it, and it helps you clear all this fuel so that it doesn't become as dangerous for when a wildfire comes through. And then in addition to that, we're also, you know, putting metal roofs on the buildings to protect them. And we're really leaning into practices around defensible space. So monitoring what's around the homes, what's the landscaping looking like, how close do we put particular plants? Are we mulching with wood versus other materials? Do we not want to mulch around the homes? And then there's this, ironically, as we're building, like, let's say a deck, you're like, should I put material that's non-flammable, that has been heavily treated, that might still get a little charred if a fire comes here? Or should I just do regular wood that will least leave less toxins in the soil, but will definitely just like go up in flames? So these are difficult decisions. And I think we're doing a good job at navigating them. Yeah.
So we have a couple more questions before we end, but okay. I do want to remind the listeners that we're going to extend this conversation, and
you can visit our website,
Eco Justice Radio. So if you want to continue the conversation, definitely go over there. So one of the last questions here, what are the next steps for Shelterwood Collective?
Yeah. So this beautiful building that I was just talking about, this two-story, 18 bed, universally designed building, we want to make it a reality. By start breaking ground by 2024. So we're going to be launching a capital campaign, which folks are encouraged to follow our Instagram or our listserv to start learning more around the progression of that. There they are. I heard them this time. I heard my dogs this time. I think that fundraising is a big part of our startup phase at the moment. And folks can follow our journey through social media.
And that's my last question for you. Where can people, last question before we extend the show and people can listen on Patreon, but where can people find your work, follow you on social media, and support the Shelterwood Collective?
Yeah, you can find us on our website, www.shelterwoodcollective.org. And you can follow us on Instagram, shelterwood_collective. And if you are encouraged, if you are excited about following our work, sign up for our listserv, which is going to be on our website. Right now, because of our small staff, we're not hyper communicating on so many platforms, but I do think we're staying pretty on top of it. So you will get invited to volunteer days. You might hear about a fundraiser, but we're definitely trying to share our story.
Well, I thank you so much for sharing your story here today on Eco Justice Radio and to our listeners. And definitely everyone go check out their social media. We will have a blog post with more information, so you can check that out as well. Thank you, Lael, for being on the show. And it was really great to have you.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And for everyone that wants to continue the conversation again, go to Eco Justice Radio. We've got a few more questions for our guest. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore other shows, subscribe to our podcast and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Reclaiming Land, Culture, and Narrative through Black, Indigenous, and Queer Stewardship. Thank you to our guest, Lael Camargo, co-founder and co-executive director at Shelterwood Collective. Please connect with us on social media. You can find us at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal 350, and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, well, subscribe and share the episodes. been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. Executive producer Jack Eit, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification.